welcome to the Cure for Chronic Pain podcast with me, Nicole Sachs. You are here.
Hello, my loves. How are you today? This is Nicole, and you have reached my podcast, The Cure for Chronic Pain, with me, Nicole Sachs. Welcome to it. Very excited to be here with you today. So I have been thinking a lot lately about belief. And I really want to do a whole podcast episode that dives into the concept of belief because it's such a misunderstood word. I've probably talked about it plenty of times before, but I want to really focus in on it. The reason I think it's a misunderstood word or maybe just a word that's not examined deeply enough is that our perception is our reality. The only way the nervous system has any idea whether or not to protect you is from your conscious and unconscious input. What is it getting? What is it getting from you? And so when we believe something to be true and we place power in that belief, when that belief either leads us to look at life through the lens of love or through the lens of fear, it determines a tremendous difference in our outcomes. And so I really, really want to talk more about that. And the reason I'm talking at least a little bit about that right now is because lately I've been thinking about the three legs of the stool of the three facets of my work: believe, do the work, and patience and kindness for yourself. And, you know, do the work, which we focus on a lot here on this podcast, which is a journal, speak, and meditation practice, is key. It's key because it is the best vehicle I have found in my many, many years of practice and working with others to lower the emotional reservoir and stop the nervous system from being triggered into fight or flight. Having said that, belief is so important. That leg of the stool needs to be robust because until you believe that you are actually okay, that you really, really don't need to run to the next doctor or specialist or procedure or treatment or supplement. Like until you get it, that there's nothing you have to worry about. You just have to calmly slow down and do the work. You need to regulate your nervous system and all of your issues will resolve. It's really hard to get there because you are constantly being triggered into fear. So I wanted to talk about the brain science. I have a colleague, Lisa, and I have been working with her for over a year now. And Gigi is an incredible success story of TMS work and a chronic pain practitioner. She's a member of the Cure for Chronic Pain team. She teaches with us at Omega, and she will be there this summer for all of you guys who are on the fence deciding about Omega. Gigi will be one of our instructors. She will be there the whole week. So anyway, just to note, but anyway, I first interviewed Gigi about a year and a half ago when I first met her, and we were talking about her incredible recovery. And she is a person who's not only lived through this, but she is a biologist. She has studied at Oxford University. She is a really brilliant mind, and she's excellent at explaining the brain science in a way that just really disarms you. It really makes you understand there's nothing to be scared of. The science is on our side. Your brain and your nervous system are actually working perfectly when you are suffering chronic pain, even though that is so not the way you want to live. And I call it safe in the unsafest way. And we talk all about the confused brain and nervous system and how this protection is unwarranted and unasked for. And so anyway, Gigi and I have gotten together and we are going to do a brain science deep dive, an understanding of why the brain and the nervous system seek to protect us with chronic pain and issues, because of course, pain is inherently in the human body a protective function. It's a protective topic. It's, you know, we don't suffer in pain for sport. We suffer in pain because we are trying to protect ourselves from further injury. And that's something that really becomes clear when you understand the brain science. So we're going to do a virtual mini retreat live and on Zoom, April 28th from 10 to 12 Pacific. It will be recorded for everyone who purchases a ticket. It's only $45, and it's if you would like to join us, I would get on it right away because I think this one's going to sell out quickly. You can go to my website, thecureforchronicpain.com, and click on the retreats tab, and you can also go to my Instagram bio at Nicole Sachs LCSW and click on the Instagram bio, and you will see it. It'll be the first link to join. So I decided in preparation for this event to replay my conversation with Gigi so you guys understand not only is she a scientist and someone who really understands this process in the human body, she is a survivor. She is a patient. She is the way I am. She entered this through the suffering of her own body and learned this painful thing we have to learn, which is sometimes we don't know everything. Sometimes, no matter how studied we are, we don't actually understand what's going on. And when you can awaken to new truths that perhaps you have not yet acknowledged, your entire life just cracks open and it's amazing. So I wanted to share that with you so you can inspire yourself for your own journey because it's so important to remain inspired. That's also part of belief. Staying hopeful, knowing that there is a light and you're continuing to follow it. So that is going to be our podcast today. So I'm going to leave you there with that message. No need to do any other housekeeping because I really want to keep us focused on the brain science today. I'm sending you big love, and I hope I see your face on the 28th because I think this is going to be a really, really heart-opening and mind-opening event that a lot of people need. All right, big love. Enjoy this interview with Gigi.
Hello, everybody. Today I'm here with Gigi. Welcome, Gigi.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so thrilled that you're here. I love when I get to talk to someone who has been through it in many different ways and is so articulate and so able to describe her journey, but also to help kind of get into the little places where we might not always have a chance to talk. And you guys will hear what I'm talking about as Gigi has her master's. Is it in biology?
Yes, yeah,
In biology
exactly.
from Oxford. So it's such a wonderful as we move through a story, it's such a wonderful thing to focus on how we can hold space for both the incredibly scientific and important realities of Western medical model and also hold space for inviting in something new that is essential for our health, as Gigi learned in the course of her journey. So I just felt the need to say that at the front, but I definitely want you to start wherever you want to start, Gigi, and tell us like what happened and how it brought you through this journey and where you are today.
Yeah, gosh. Well, it's so difficult to even know where to begin because I had my symptoms for over a decade and I experienced a whole host of different symptoms and conditions and diagnoses that just kept piling on top of one another. But I guess the very first place, or the best place to start, is my first diagnosis, which I got when I was around 13, 14 years old. And I was diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos type 3, which I think now is referred to as Ehlers-Danlos hypermobility. And
Right.
yes. So I was at the time I was experiencing tachycardia. My heart rate, even when I was just chilling on the sofa, was around 140. I was experiencing heart arrhythmia, and I was then subsequently diagnosed with POTS because I was really struggling to sit up in bed. Every time I would try and stand up or sit up, I would have these incredible dizzy waves. And so I was taken to the doctor and I did all sorts of tests, including the tilt table test. And then that's where I was diagnosed with POTS. And I was given and prescribed all sorts of medications. And I was told that I could eat the world's supply of salt and be totally fine because my doctor told me that I had the lowest blood pressure he'd ever seen in a conscious person, which is always a very encouraging thing to be told.
Yeah.
But so I just struggled with many years and none of it helped. None of it worked. None of the dietary changes, none of the medication helped me at all. And, even more so than that, my symptoms then developed. So it wasn't just heart problems and low blood pressure. It then developed into neuropathy. So I would have these funny tingling sensations in my arms and my legs, or what would feel like currents running through my fingers. And then I would also have these bizarre sensations that felt almost like an egg cracking on my head. So I would feel it cracking on my head, and then I would almost feel what felt like egg yolk running down my head until it reached my eyes. And then it reached my eyes, I would start to feel very dizzy and like I was about to pass out. So
wow,
you can imagine.
That's an interesting one for sure.
Yes. So I was experiencing a lot of these symptoms, and I was going to the doctor and getting the sort of raised eyebrow and, okay, I think we might need to check this out a little bit more and do more investigations. So I had multiple MRIs, CT scans, x-rays, mainly at the time to check for MS, because a lot of the symptoms that I had were very similar to what you would expect for that. And everything came back clear. And at the time, the doctors told me, oh, well, you're lucky that things, you know, it's good news, everything's come back clear. But I'm sure many people can relate to the fact that when you are totally debilitated and feel like you can't do anything, that is actually not so reassuring to be told that right. No one has any idea of what's going on with you.
Oh, yeah. It's a real helpless stance that I hear countless times in the way, you know, walking through the world of this work, that people are almost relieved to get a diagnosis because they just want to know that someone can help them.
Totally, totally. And that's why I went to see so many different specialists. I mean, I think I've seen every medical specialist that exists. And it was just because I was hoping that somebody would say, oh, okay, thank God you've come to see me, because I know exactly what's going on with you. And unfortunately, I never received that. So what ended up actually happening was all of my symptoms just continued with no real resolution or any satisfactory explanation for why they had even started in the first place. And every doctor I just saw just blamed every symptom I had developed on my Ehlers-Danlos, which never made any sense to me from a biological perspective, because Ehlers-Danlos is genetic. I was born with it. And yet I'd had an incredibly very healthy childhood. Nothing had been, you know, I didn't have any major physical symptoms and was running around totally fine. So I didn't really understand why I could have Ehlers-Danlos as a child and be totally fine. And yet as I grew older, this was suddenly an issue.
Right.
The only thing that I would notice, the only pattern that I could sort of glean, was what I would have, what my mum liked to call these health explosions after stressful events. And more often than not, these stressful events were school related. So just like many other TMS personalities, I was a huge perfectionist and I was incredibly sensitive and I just wanted to do well and I wanted to make my parents proud. And I just put this huge, enormous pressure on myself to do well at school. So every time it would come to exams, and this was whilst I was at high school, but also when I was at University of Oxford and then during my postgrad, after every set of tests or exams, I would spend my whole time revising, thinking, oh, thank goodness I've got the summer to look forward to and to spend time with my friends. And every single time the exam season was over, I would have some huge flare up and spend the summer completely laid low, being unable to do anything.
Right. So, I mean, that's obviously, like, there's no way for you to have known about TMS at the time, but I mean, my goodness, what could be more clear?
Totally. Exactly. When I look back on it now, I'm like, oh, well, look, I was talking about being a perfectionist. I was doing TMS perfectly.
Yes, you were.
So, you know, this was how I was living my life, just through booms and busts, just completely overworking myself and then having to deal with the repercussions of that. And this is how everything was going until my bladder symptoms began, which really changed everything. And unsurprisingly enough, they started after an extremely stressful period where my mum, who is my bestest friend, had a health emergency. And it started with what felt like a slow stream. I just thought, oh, okay, it feels like, you know, I'm going to the loo and it's a bit weaker than normal. And then it sort of developed into, oh, I've just gone to the bathroom, but yet it feels like I need to go again straight away.
Right. Urgency.
So exactly. So there was a slow stream, then urgency, and then this developed into it became increasingly more uncomfortable, and this uncomfortable sensation combined with the urgency then turned into full-blown excruciating pain. So I took what a lot of people take when they think they might have an infection. So I had taken some D-mannos and other things and hadn't had any
relief. Did you have any infection present when you were tested?
No. So when I went to the doctor, I had all these cultures done, all these tests done, urine samples, etc., and nothing was found. So at this point, I kept returning to the doctor. I think they probably were getting incredibly bored of me in the office, because every single day I'd be showing up saying, it's still here and I need another urine sample, because there has to be something that you're missing. And so every single day I would have another culture taken and it would come back clear. And after a period of time, my doctor, who was incredibly kind and sympathetic, sat me down and said, look, we've done so many samples here. I don't think that you've got an infection. I think we're going to have to call it interstitial cystitis. And she explained it to me and she said, this is a chronic condition that people learn how to deal with for the rest of their life.
I get when I hear this.
Exactly. And this is just going to have to be something that we have to learn how to deal with. And there are dietary changes and et cetera, that you can begin to look into. So knowing me, the first thing I did is I went straight onto the academic papers, and I very quickly descended into full-blown panic research mode. And I don't know if there's anyone who would listen to this who's done a similar thing to me, but all of the papers are the most horrendous, depressing read. It's just awful, because you're told that there's no cause. We have no idea what causes it. We've got no cure for it. The treatment options are terrible. Quality of life is terrible. And by this stage, you know, I could agree with all of that. I was totally bedridden. My mum was completely looking after me. I was unable to do any work, unable to do anything. And I'd basically fully given up on having a chance at a normal life, which is just so sad.
And how old were you at this point, Gigi?
This was when I, early 20s, so 20 or 21, I think.
That's just, you know, this is the thing that, you know, I'm really wanting to highlight, because, you know, your voice sounds young. My voice sounds young. Nobody knows how old anyone is on a podcast. Like, you guys, this is a baby, a mm-hmm. sweet young baby who is not sure if she's going to have any quality of life at the age of 21. Like, this is where I get very, very adamant in spreading the message of this work, because it is so imperative that people understand the power of nervous system dysregulation and what it can do to send signals to the brain, to send signals to the body of different pain and inflammation and things that you couldn't imagine. You know, I have a private community going on right now, and I just had a woman asked this morning, can you have recurring UTIs? Can you have that as a result of this dysregulation? Is this TMS? And I said, absolutely. And then, of course, I'm jumping on this podcast with you and we're talking about the exact same thing. And it's just so imperative that people understand that the most bizarre, the most unexplainable things can happen to your body in this state of repressed emotional world, stress, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm. Totally. I completely agree. And I often say to people now, TMS type symptoms can be the most severe, because there's no finite end to it. It's just how much fear your brain is receiving determines how bad the symptoms are going to get. And if you enter into this negative feedback loop, you can end up with the most incredibly severe symptoms, because your brain has unintentionally learned how to be incredibly good at producing all of this pain.
Yes.
So often it's actually even more severe than you would expect for a structural condition. And this is only something that I learned subsequently. But at the time, I just assumed there is no way that, well, I didn't even know about TMS at the time, but there's no way I would have even assumed that this could be anything else other than something structural, because the symptoms were so severe. And, you know, like I said, I really at the age of 20 had completely given up hope on being able to live my life, which is just an unbelievable thing to say. So meanwhile, whilst I was researching all of, you know, all of these academic papers, going down a rabbit hole that was getting me absolutely nowhere, my mum, who not only was my best friend, but, you know, my greatest health advocate, was far, far more open-minded. And I remember there was an evening and I'd been hysterically crying, saying that I just couldn't do it anymore. And my mum just said, well, I'm sending up a prayer that we're going to get a message telling us what to do next, that we're going to get a sign of or some help on where to lead us or what to do. And she went up to bed and she was looking through Apple Podcasts, and what came up but your podcast.
So, love it.
Exactly. So she gave it a listen and immediately thought, oh my gosh, all of these people sound just like Gigi. They're exactly the same, their personalities are the same, their, you know, their symptoms are the same. And she was absolutely convinced from the get-go that this was 100% what was going on with me. And the next morning she came to me and she said, I really think I found it. I think I've discovered what's gone on. And she described sort of the relationship between...
I bet you loved that.
Oh, hugely. I was so gracious and appreciative. ran into her arms and said, thank you. No, in actual fact, I was incredibly offended.
And which is what I expected.
Totally. And I said to her, look, you clearly have absolutely no idea what I'm going through if you think that this is all in my head, which I think is the famous phrase or the thing that we often think when we first find out about this work, is we assume that people are telling us that it's imaginary. Yes. And that it's not real. And it's just, you know, it's just in our head, which couldn't be further from the truth.
That's right. That's- and like I whenever it's mentioned, I just need to, you know, jump in with my flags flying and say, this is brain science. This has nothing to do with making it up or imagination. And I get it. You know, I've been defending Dr. Sarno's work for 25 years, and I get it that people feel like anytime you say the word emotion immediately brings up, you know, everyone's hackles, and they say, well, don't tell me that I'm making this up. Don't tell me that I'm hysterical. Don't tell me that I'm overreacting. And it's nothing. It's not even in the same ballpark. It's not even related to that. But I always thank you for bringing it up, because I always want an opportunity to say, no, this is about neural pathways. It's about brain science. It's about fight, flight, or freeze. And that is something that once people get it, they have the opportunity to move toward the healing.
Exactly. No, totally. And I think that this is something that was a real resistance point for me. I was just completely obsessed with the idea that I thought that this meant that the pain was imaginary, which I knew it wasn't, because I was the person experiencing it. So I was incredibly offended, and I just backed off and said, right, okay, you don't understand. I'm just going to continue on my own journey. And so I just kept searching and searching. And at the time, the infection hypothesis was very popular for interstitial cystitis. And there was a very well-known professor in the UK who prescribed antibiotics to sort of combat these symptoms. So I went on some antibiotics. And I know this sounds strange from a mind-body perspective, but it was the best decision I ever made. Because when I went on these antibiotics, my symptoms were an 11 out of 10 the morning that I decided to take them. And within 2 hours or so, my symptoms had gone from an 11 out of 10 to around a 3 out of 10. They just drastically dropped. And given my scientific background, I just thought, huh, that's a little bit weird, because antibiotics right. don't work that
they
quickly.
They can't possibly. So I guess what I'm hearing you say is the reason the antibiotics were the best thing you ever did is because you are scientifically minded enough that you knew it was impossible to have pain cessation that quickly. So it opened your mind to what's really going on.
Totally. And I think at the time I was in such an acute state of fight or flight, I needed something that I totally believed in to yes. calm me down.
Yes.
And the antibiotics provided that I really genuinely believed in this hypothesis and this idea, because, you know, I just thought, okay, well, here is somebody who's finally understanding how real my symptoms are and are giving me a real solution to them. That's how I interpreted the antibiotic idea. Right.
It checked all the boxes for you, because it checked the medical box in terms of, you know, putting a medicine in your body to help you. And it checked the hopelessness box off, meaning, you know, it's not just like, oh, you're going to have to deal with this for the rest of your life. It's, I know and I can help you. And these are things that I'm trying to always replace. I'm trying to stand up and say, there can be another way to find those two answers. But I actually really love it, though, that you got there through the door you needed to get through. Like, we all need to go through the doors we need to go through to get here.
100%. And I think sometimes the path that I think there are a lot of people even now that I've spoken with who really find it difficult to just hop on the belief train straight away.
Right.
And they kind of need proof in their own way and to build up that evidence in a way that resonates for them. And for me, it just so happened that my belief in mind body came from the fact that I understood that there was no way that some antibiotics I was taking could have worked so quickly. And this was then compounded by the fact that I continued taking the antibiotics because I thought, well, it's working, so I'm not going to jinx it. I'm just going to carry on taking them. But on day 4, my symptoms started coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really, yeah, of course, because by that point, the impact of taking the pill, the relief that I had gotten initially from taking the pill was wearing off. So my brain was going back into a cycle of feeling less and less safe. So my symptoms were coming back.
Yes, yes.
So I thought on day 4, when my symptoms started coming back, I thought, right, okay, I've got to stay objective with this. My symptoms went away so quickly. There's no way that could have actually been to do with the antibiotics. And now they're coming back and I'm still on the antibiotics. So if it was an infection, this just wouldn't be happening, because there's no explanation for this. So it was at this point that, sort of with tail between my legs, I went back to my mum and I said, what was that podcast that you mentioned? So I went on and I, of course, being slightly obsessive, I looked through absolutely every single episode that you'd released at the time and went straight for the pelvic pain podcast initially. And then you also had POTS podcasts and many other things that I'd experienced. And I thought, well, this is kind of a bit of a coincidence that everything I've been diagnosed with in my entire life is featuring on this podcast. So I started taking it a lot more seriously. And I remember specifically listening to the Whitney Riedman podcast and thinking, well, there is no denying that this person has struggled as much as I'm struggling now. There's no denying that her symptoms weren't as severe as what I'm experiencing now. And I think that was really the start of my recovery journey, because there was just that glimmer of hope that I needed, that actually not only is this something, not only could I have a potential name for what is going on with me, but it has a cure. Which is the most important thing. It's not just an empty diagnosis or a descriptive term. Here is a solution to everything that I'd actually been struggling with for over a decade.
Totally. And I will say, one of the biggest criticisms I have received over the past however many years since I started this brand is, how dare you say there is a cure for chronic pain? And my response is, because chronic pain is an epidemic of fear. And as soon as we start to quiet that fear and regulate the nervous system, there is a cure for chronic pain. There's no cure for pain. You know, pain is necessary. Pain is part of the human experience. It's what helps us slow down when our bodies need to rest. It's what helps us triumph when we need to grow through something uncomfortable. Like, we need our pain, but chronic pain is an epidemic of fear. And it's really basically unnecessary when you understand this. Your brain and your nervous system stop firing those same signals. And I'm preaching to you, which is to the choir, but I hope someone else might be listening that needs to hear that.
Of course, 100%. And I think I have the same issue with the word remission. When people say, oh, I'm in remission from my chronic pain. And I think that that is just such a ridiculous way of describing it, in my opinion, because that would be the equivalent of breaking your ankle and healing and having the pain go away and saying, I'm in remission from pain right now.
You know,
it is just as silly. Pain is a protective strategy that the brain has. It's a danger alarm signal. And we don't want that danger alarm signal to disappear entirely. We just want to maintain our life, or we want to look after ourselves to the point where our brain doesn't have to fire off the danger alarm signal all of the time.
Yes.
So I was doing a whole bunch of, I then transitioned from doing a deep dive in all of the academic literature to doing a deep dive in the academic literature, but not for interstitial cystitis, but for mind-body medicine. And I, you know, there are so many incredibly good papers out there now that really just demonstrated to me, oh, okay, this is an entirely legit branch of neuroscience, and I just hadn't heard of it before, and I need to get with it rather than just assume that it's a load of baloney.
Right.
And so I started initially with journal speak, and you know, I found that there had been so many things that happened in my life that when I looked back, I could think, well, of course this, you know, resulted in making me feel unsafe. Of course, this was something that was going to sensitize my brain and make it more likely to fire off in the future. And, you know, part of that started with an analysis of how my interstitial cystitis symptoms had started and the health emergency that happened with my mum. And what I realized is that I'd always been quite good at expressing what's socially acceptable. I wasn't sort of a quiet, meek and mild kid. I was quite loud and occasionally obnoxious. And I was good at expressing and socializing normally, but I was less good at being aware of what my inner, deeper child's voice was saying.
Right.
So I remember so specifically with this, going back, revisiting the health emergency in a different way, I realized that on the surface, I had spent all of my time sort of being desperately worried about her, thinking, okay, how can I sort this out? What's the next doctor's appointment to go to? I need to get a, you know, organized transport here and there. I was trying to organize everything. But on a deeper level, when I did the journal speak, I wasn't saying any of that. In actual fact, I was saying, I'm frustrated. You're my mum and you should be looking after me. And here I am as a kid, and I feel abandoned. I'm the one who has pressure to make sure everything is okay. And that's not fair. I should be the one who's being looked after. So it was an entirely different way of looking at things and accessing, you know, feelings that were there that I just wasn't giving a voice to them.
And that's so perfect. It's, you know, I've been teaching this for a million years. And from the beginning, what I always told people is, it's not what you're feeling that is hurting you. It's what you're not feeling. And it's always the conflict that kills. I love you, but you're driving me crazy. I need you and I resent you for that. You know, I know that I signed up to take care of you, but now it's ruining my life. You know, like whatever. You can apply that to a million different situations. And we don't say the second part. You know, we say things like, oh God, it's so stressful and it's so hard and like I'm tired. But we don't say, I'm suffering inside because this shouldn't be my responsibility. I'm actually enraged inside, you know, and like, because it seems so unfair to be angry at a sick person or to be angry at a child. You know, I can't tell you how many parents are enraged at having to take care of their own children. And it's like, duh, of course you are. It sucks. It's really hard to take care of young kids. But not enough people really go there. And then the body carries the pain. And then what happens? You get a migraine, you get to go lie down, close the door, ask someone else to take care of your kids. Problem solved, but problem not solved. And so, you know, I really appreciate you bringing that up because it's really key. It happens underneath almost every circumstance. It's like when you see those memes and you see the little piece of the iceberg sticking out and you say, you know, this is the part you see, and then you see the enormity of the iceberg underneath and you say, but this is really what's going on. And so that really personifies it for me.
Totally. I completely agree. I often liken myself to a duck where things look smooth. I look like I'm swimming all right on the surface, or like a swan. Things look smooth on the surface, and underneath I'm just paddling away trying to keep afloat.
Right, right.
And but this journal speak really gave me the opportunity to realize there were so many things that had happened that had led me to really begin to doubt my own ability to be well. Another example was when I was around 16, I'd had an accident where the doctor had said to me, you know, you're really lucky to be alive, because where you injured yourself was a millimeter away from an artery, a major artery. So, you know, consider yourself lucky. And in that moment, I wasn't consciously aware of me being traumatized by him saying that at all. But what I realized is, on an unconscious level, the way that my brain had processed that information is, you got it wrong. You thought that you were totally fine, and you weren't. You nearly died. So right. You actually have no understanding on when you're actually in danger or not. That's the way my unconscious processed it. But when I was doing the journal speak, what I realized is, hold on, I wasn't wrong. Because I was fine, because it hadn't hit my artery. It was a millimeter away. It hadn't done it. And so it gave me a whole new perspective on why my symptoms had built up in the first place. But also it gave me the opportunity to learn how to regain that trust back with my body and my brain's ability to actually keep me safe, or to alert me when there was something that was genuinely wrong.
Yes, yes, you're fine-tuning it by understanding. You know, I always say awareness is the first step. When you start to become aware of what's going on in your body and in your mind and in your heart and, you know, all the things, then you can decide consciously. It gives you choices, and you can decide how to think about things, which of course leads to less repression, which leads to less TMS.
Exactly. So I continue with the journal speak for a solid while. And then I started to notice that I was becoming absolutely terrified if I didn't journal speak every day. And yep. I thought to myself, okay, well, this isn't healthy either. So journal speak was incredibly instrumental for me. But I also realized that I had an obsessive personality type, and I didn't want to build up more fear or just allocate more fear in a different direction. So I thought, okay, this is a useful technique and tool that I'm going to maintain when, you know, on a regular basis, but I'm not going to put myself under the pressure of making sure that I do it for 20 minutes on the dot every single day, because yes. That's just building a whole new other type of fear and concern, which isn't going to be helping my symptoms anyway.
Well, that was really good, because, you know, not everybody has that kind of insight. And people ask me this question all the time. And I say, journal speak is like any other tool. It is like mm-hmm. for your toolkit. And yes, at the very beginning, I do recommend it on a daily basis, or at least with some really good regularity, just because we have to lower the reservoir. We have to dip the ladle in and get this stuff out. You have to know that you resent your mother as well as love her. You have to know, you know, that you are obsessed with your children, but also wish they would go away. Like, you need to know these things. Having said that, the end game for all of this is to reduce our fear and the stress that we put on our brains and nervous systems to be okay. And when we are experiencing a tremendous amount of fear, even if the fear is around doing the journal speak, it's the law of diminishing returns. So I love that you were able to figure that out about yourself. So how did you modulate at that point? What did you do?
So I felt at that point, the priority that I was trying to prioritize just believing in my own safety. So I started collecting an evidence list of all of the characteristics that my symptoms had that demonstrated that I had TMS. Because I really feel like, fundamentally, if you know and you believe truly that you have TMS or mind-body syndrome or whatever you'd like to call it, then you know that you are going to get well. Because there is the fundamental science of it suggests that our brains are neuroplastic until the day that we die. And so we all have the opportunity to recover, no matter how severe or no matter how long that we've had the symptoms, because fundamentally, of course, all of our brains, all of our TMS brains are neuroplastic, because that's why we have the symptoms now, because our brains rewired to become really good at generating these symptoms. So we know that our brains can rewire. It's just a case of rewiring in the opposite direction. So I really wanted to build up my belief and conviction that I had TMS through evidence and through proof and through seeing how my symptoms behave, what made them, at the beginning, they were terrible all the time. But as I began to become more confident, then I noticed these small fluctuations that I would sort of add to my evidence sheet that would demonstrate that I was on the right path.
You know, I have to tell you, I've never heard someone say it before exactly like this. This is really brilliant. And I would like anyone listening to take note of it. Keeping an inventory is a great way to rewire. It's a great way to remind yourself. And it's funny because I do this for many years. I had a private practice and I would say to people about every 6 months, let's take stock today. What is easier than it was 6 months ago? You know, what used to get you totally hung up that you're just kind of like wearing loosely right now or letting go? And it's amazing how people need to take note or else they don't realize their growth, you know? And that's what I'm always talking about when I'm talking about ascension theory and moving in concentric circles up the mountain. So I love that you did that. And I think it's actually a great tip.
Totally. And I think we all have, this is me going into my biology brain, but from an evolutionary perspective, we all have this negativity bias. We always focus on the things that are going wrong because from a survival perspective, that's what's more likely to keep us alive. If we remember all the things that go wrong and so what not to do next, that's going to help us. But from a recovery perspective, that's not necessarily the most effective skill that we as humans have. So I really needed to counteract this by remembering the fact that I wouldn't remember all the positive things that were happening. So I really needed to write it down as proof saying, okay, well, in this moment now, I might feel like I've made zero progress at all, but I can actually see that, you know, a couple of weeks I wrote that all of this had happened. And there's no denying that that is evidence of improvement. So I would really just write all of this stuff down, build it up over time. And I often say recovery, the thing in my experience that determines who has a successful recovery or who takes a little bit longer is it's not that we have any form of extra skill or any, I don't know, extra tool. It's just the fact that it requires persistence and patience.
Yeah.
And I just didn't give up on it because I thought, well, this is what it is. And if this is what it is, I'm going to get well. There's no doubt about that. And so I just really stuck at it. And I never say how long it took me to recover, which is so annoying because I know when I listen to all of your podcasts previously, I would occasionally fast forward to hear when people say how long it took them to get better. But the reason I don't is because it wasn't an easy road. I think I made every single mistake that there was to make in the book, but it was just eventually I did get there. And I don't think that necessarily giving a time limit is useful because everybody is different. Yeah. And this is something that I've spoken about with tons of people in their own recovery stories. I am amazed by how different everybody's recovery stories are. But the one thing that unites us all is that, like I said previously, we didn't give up. So, you know, that's something that if anybody is listening to this now, which I'm sure there will be many people, it's that's really the key, is it doesn't matter how long. There are some people who resonate and they immediately know they're going to get well and their brain takes huge comfort in that fact and they experience, you know, symptom relief very quickly. And then there are other people like myself who really needed to prove it to myself consistently again and again and again. But eventually you will get there.
Do you think, Gigi, that your medical background, meaning your biological studies, you know, I think I mentioned at the top of the podcast, Gigi has her master's in biology from Oxford. So obviously, and you can hear even in her, the way she can articulate that her brain works in very scientific ways and she's willing to study and to do deep dives. Do you think that kept you from a quicker recovery? Like, do you, where do you think that plays a role in people's lives? Like, our skepticism based on real intelligence and knowledge of things that are real. I mean, we are biologically a certain way and our bodies do carry illness, and there is a great deal to be gained from the Western medical model. And at the same time, we have to have willingness to see beyond that in order to heal. So what do you find that can be helpful in explaining that to people?
I think for me at the beginning, it really caused a lot of resistance in taking the work seriously to start with, because there's just so much misinformation about this work. And there's just there's a lot more now in the mainstream media than when I was struggling, thank goodness. But at the time, there really no one was speaking about this in sort of mainstream media. So I think that background initially held me back. But I think that once I had fully taken it seriously and listened to your recovery stories. And you can't deny people's experience. Once you hear a recovery story, you can't tell that person that they're making it up, or you can't tell that person that they haven't recovered. I mean, that is ridiculous. And in actual fact, I think that's where the scientific backing helped me, because in science, you have a hypothesis, but you start with a null hypothesis, which is assuming that any change is significant. So when I hear somebody's recovery stories, it would be unscientific of me to say, well, that's not true, or that doesn't fit my way of thinking, so I'm going to assume that they're making it up. That's the opposite of good scientific practice. So I think actually the recovery stories were so instrumental for me, because I had to take them seriously. There are so many of them. So it would be absurd to do anything other than that. So I think past that point, it really allowed me to sort of look at things with more of a beginner's mind and with a more open perspective and willingness to accept that, you know, there was going to be a lot that I didn't know, and I needed to actually, you know, use my skills of being inquisitive and finding this interesting to use those skills in my favor rather than to my detriment. So I think at the beginning, they were a bit of a sticking point, and then they ended up really helping me in my recovery because they solidified my understanding of the neuroscience. They, you know, it made me just genuinely passionately interested in it, which is why now I'm so passionate about demonstrating this in the scientific literature. So I'm in the process of writing up case studies and hopefully designing clinical trials to demonstrate the effectiveness of this mind-body work to help change medical guidelines, because that's something that I'm just so enormously passionate about, because I really want people to appreciate from all walks of life, whether you're naturally a more spiritual person or you're a more scientific, more scientifically minded, that you know that this work applies to everybody.
Oh my God. Well, thank God. Thank God you're out there, because I am sitting here in my space thinking to myself, what more can I do? And in the end, you know, I mean, there's always more anybody can do, but it makes me feel so great that your scientific mind was eased by what I do, which is bring the stories to the fore. Because, you know, in many ways, what I am is a storyteller. You know, I'm telling my own story, and I'm helping other people tell theirs, because I'm not a scientist. I'm a therapist. So, I mean, I guess I'm in the world of medicine and science, but for the most part, I'm in the world of being a human being. And I know that there's no cure for the human condition. And I also know there is no need for us to be in chronic pain, symptoms, conditions, diagnoses. There is no need. It is a protective stance. It's like wearing a shell. And that shell keeps us between, you know, it stands between us and our joy and our presence. And so I'm so thrilled, you know, that you exist and that people are taking this seriously, because, you know, similar, you know, your entire story spans over a few years. My story spans over a couple of generations. And I'll tell you, there was no one talking about this when Dr. Sarno was coming out with it. No one. I mean, he was ostracized completely. And so I'm glad that we're evolving it, because that's what needs to happen.
Totally. I think that medicine is so slow moving and it takes so many years of evidence in the literature before things begin to filter through. But in the same way recovery takes persistence and patience, change to guidelines takes persistence and patience. And, you know, this is a collective movement of everybody's voices coming together to say that you can't ignore this any longer. You can't dismiss this any longer. And this isn't something that, oh, if you help reduce your anxiety a little bit, you might have your symptoms improve. No, I mean, that completely demeans this whole experience. You can completely recover from chronic pain by looking after yourself, by taking care of yourself, by prioritizing your safety, by viewing your own self-worth as a priority rather than the last on your list. And I just think that, you know, I always said to my mum, if I can ever view these symptoms as a blessing, I don't know what will have happened to me, but it will be the greatest miracle on earth.
Right.
And this genuinely, I can look back at my, you know, decade of symptoms and say I can genuinely, hand on my heart, say that that was the greatest blessing that I ever went through. It was the most horrible period, but it was also the greatest blessing because it completely transformed the way that I live my life now, the way that I interact with people, the empathy it's given me. You know, you can sympathize with people's conditions, but you can't empathize unless you've been through something similar.
Right.
And it's just totally transformed my ability to relate to other humans on a deeper level. And I'm genuinely so, so grateful that I learned this lesson earlier on. And it's, you know, and hopefully you can share that with other people.
Yes. So that's a perfect segue. Tell us a little bit about your life today. You know, what does it mean for you to be a person who is free of chronic pain? Because I know I'm constantly talking about what it means for me. And, you know, what it means for me is that things come up. I get a symptom, I'll get a headache, I'll get like, you know, I'll wake up and like, I'll feel like my upper back, my scapula, I call it the wing. You know, I have different symptom imperatives, but instead of getting scared, which I never do, I wear it loosely. I do my journal speak if I need to. I take care of myself. I draw boundaries. I, you know, take note of my people pleasing and my perfectionism. I make sure that I'm not selling myself down the river just to have other people be happy, and it passes. And I would never consider anything I have chronic. So how does that show up for you?
Totally. I completely relate to what you've just said. I think that now it's changed the way that I work. So I've dedicated my life to trying to help other people going through similar conditions and letting them know that they're not alone. But I also recognize that I can only do that by looking after myself. So when I get a symptom that comes up, and by the way, I want people to know, when I listen to this and I would hear someone say, when I get a symptom come up, I would immediately go, oh my gosh, does that mean that they haven't fully recovered? Does that mean that this is something that's lifelong?
Right, right.
And I want people to know that, no, I have completely recovered. I would never say that I have interstitial cystitis, or never say that I have POTS or any of the fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, any of those diagnoses. But say I've had a busy time, I've been traveling a lot, or I have a lot of work calls and I'm feeling a little bit tired. Before, I may try and push through and fit an extra thing in and just push myself a little bit harder. Whereas now I look at that fatigue, I don't look at it with any fear or any apprehension. And I just say, okay, well, I know what you are. You're a danger alarm signal. You're a barometer for my unconscious brain's perception of danger, of what's going on. So you need to take some time out. So I focus so much more now on, you know, whether it's meditation, breathing exercises, controlling my nervous system more, allocating some extra spare time for me just to cool down at the end of the day. These are all different techniques and practices that I sort of implement. And these techniques change depending on where you are, what season of life you're in. So there might be times that I actually, being around friends is what I need. I need that external positive sort of life force energy. And there are other times where what I actually really need is just to be by myself and just to recharge and be alone. So I try and take it as it comes and not give myself prescribed thing, say, oh, I always have to do this if I'm feeling bad. I think it really just depends on where I am in the moment.
So you're paying attention.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that people overcomplicate this so much. It's almost like I'm called at this moment to just like really boil it down for people, you know? So I'll say this, the reason you're in chronic pain is because your brain and your nervous system feel that you are in danger. They feel that you're in danger because you're overwrought with both repressing the things that you have not yet been able to get to, all that leftover childhood stuff and inner trauma and all the things that we talk about for ages in this podcast. And you're also overwrought because of your daily life, because we are a over-scheduled, over-busied species. And so that sends up a danger signal. And the danger signal says slow down. And there's many, many, many thousands of diagnoses that can make you slow down. So that's where you're at. It's okay. It's normal. It's perfect, actually. Those of us in chronic pain, our nervous systems and brains are functioning perfectly, slowing you down when there's danger present. We do the things we need to do to eliminate the danger. We, you know, we put a ladle into the reservoir through journal speak and through meditation. We calm the nervous system and through all these different awarenesses, as Gigi's saying about, you know, like you can't just keep going until you run into the wall. That's dangerous. You can't people please and constantly put yourself last. That's dangerous. Perfectionism is toxic to the nervous system because it's impossible to be perfect. That's dangerous. We do what we can in our awareness to eliminate the danger signal. And the pain signals stop firing. It's that simple. And it's like, you know, I know that it's, I always say this is simple, but it's not easy because doing the work is not easy. You'll experience tons of resistance. The resistance will whisper in your ear, in your own voice saying, ugh, this will never work, or this has got to be bullshit, or you're too tired, or you're too busy. And you say, thanks for sharing, like you would to a hysterical tantruming child that just, you know, she just needs to go to bed. You say, thanks for sharing, and you do the work. And then you arrive on the shore where Gigi and I both stand, where life isn't perfect and all your problems aren't fixed. And you do have moments of pain and you have moments of fatigue, but you say, here we are. Here we are living a human life, and isn't it something? And like that's all there is. Like it's so beautiful whenever I have a chance to look at it like that, because it's really what's going on.
Totally. And I feel like you raised the most important point where your life does not have to be perfect in order to heal either. You know, no. I have a lot of people who ask me now, you know, I have tons of stress going on. Does that mean I'm never going to be able to recover? Does that mean that I'm just doomed to this life? And I always say, absolutely not. But it's just a case of finding a way, finding the tools to prioritize yourself in these stressful situations, just as you said earlier, to get a ladle to that emotional barrel and just to have a purge to the system. Yes. If you're constantly filling up that emotional barrel, we have to have a tap to empty it out. And if we can just fit that tap, we can begin our recovery journey, even if there's, you know, even if there's still things being added to that.
Yes, yes. Well, Gigi, this has been such an awesome chat. I just so many gold nuggets here. Before we wrap, I always like to give you a chance. Is there any one big piece of advice that you haven't yet mentioned that you'd love to give to people potentially sitting here listening on their toughest day?
I think that the thing I just really want to emphasize more than anything is you can recover. That severe symptoms does not have to mean that there is something structurally wrong with you. That this work really can, total recovery is completely possible for the most severe pain, the most severe conditions. I've experienced it myself, and I've seen so many others in their recovery journeys. And, you know, this is something that I started from I was incredibly skeptical about to begin with, and I have seen it time and time and time and time again with my own eyes. So please don't doubt yourself. We always think that we might be the one who might not recover.
Yes, yes.
We all think that. And so we must take comfort from the fact that we all have had that thought. That is not a unique thought. And yet we recover. We all do it. So just stick in there. I totally believe in everyone who is listening, and I totally believe in all of your recoveries.
Amazing. Amazing. You're like a little me. I love it. I love it because you know what? Certainty is what causes safety. The reason that the antibiotics worked in 2 hours, miraculously, is because your brain and your nervous system said, oh, this is it. Now, obviously, that didn't turn out to be it, but it doesn't matter. In the moment, you borrowed the certainty from your perception of the antibiotics to have that awakening. And I really invite each of you out there listening to borrow Gigi and my certainty, borrow our certainty, take it, hold it like a little stuffed animal. You can have it for now because you will eventually build your own. And that's the way this works. Well, Gigi, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much. Like I always thought that this would, if I ever recovered, this would be the greatest, greatest privilege that I could ever have to be on your podcast. So I'm so grateful to you. And, you know, I hadn't even had a chance to mention it in the past, you know, 50 minutes that we've been speaking. But honestly, Nicole, you totally saved my life. And I am so grateful for your podcast and all the work that you do. I'll never be able to put that into words, but I'm genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, so, so grateful.
Well, I receive that. Thank you, Gigi. You know, and in the moments when this podcast, which is a total labor of love for me, becomes arduous, I think of people like you, and I think of not only your own one precious life, which of course is precious beyond measure, but what you will do in this world to affect others. And this is the ripple effect of human goodness. And I'm really happy to be part of it. So thank you for that. And for all of you guys out there, I'm so thrilled to share this with you today. I wish you love and light. Hopefully on this day, we've made it a little bit brighter. And until next time, this has been the Cure for Chronic Pain podcast with me, Nicole Sachs, and I'll see you then. Bye-bye.